And we have the pleasure now to connect with an incredible musician, an artist that we greatly admire here at Radio Primavera Sound, who is about to drop a new album very soon titled Five Ways to Say Goodbye. And he's actually going to be visiting Spain very soon to, I imagine, perform some of these new songs, as well as songs from Fantasmagoria in Blue, an album of duets he has recorded with a Mexican singer, Amanda Acevedo. On the line we have Mick Harvey.
Hello. David. Is it David?
Johan.
David? It says, oh, you're, yeah. Johan.
David
are you
our
David?
Technician.
No, I'm Ben. I'm Ben.
You're Ben?
Yes.
Oh, Ben and Johan. Hello. Yeah. I've got the wrong names here on my screen. I'm Mick Harvey anyway. Hello. I'm speaking to you from Melbourne. So it's dark and it's getting cold here.
Well, it's very
just so you set the scene.
Well, in Barcelona, it's hay fever time. It's
right.
It's basically, it's very nice, but you can't walk down.
The plane trees out. Oh, and stuff too.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I imagine you're looking forward to touring through Europe in springtime. Is that something? Are you excited about this tour?
I always enjoy traveling to Europe and traveling around Europe. I don't normally think about the season unless it's between December and March, in which case I'm not looking forward to it. Aside from that, it's all fine by me. I don't really mind. As long as there's not snow and it's not freezing, I really don't mind.
Yeah.
But I always love coming to Europe to play, so I'm always looking forward to that.
I mean, after decades of globetrotting and living in places like Berlin and London and traveling the world and recording and playing making music, which parts of the planet do you love returning to?
Oh, well, loads of them. I don't know. I do enjoy traveling. I'm a terrible tourist because I'm so used to traveling for work and having a purpose when I'm somewhere. I find if I'm somewhere and I'm just a tourist that I feel like an idiot, and I don't know what to do. And people start asking you where you're from, and I think, oh God, I wish I wasn't doing this. Maybe I should just go home. But I do really love traveling and having something to do. Like there's a reason for you being there. I find really you see a different side of places and experience things quite differently. And you don't do a lot of the tourist things, and I really enjoy it. I've always enjoyed it, haven't stopped enjoying it. But particularly, places, loads of places in Europe, South America, I hardly ever get to. I love going to South America or Latin America, anywhere really. It's all,
Are you a bit of a workaholic then? I mean, because I was looking at...
Well, people say people do accuse me of that. But I mean, for a workaholic, I really, when I get a bit of downtime, I just enjoy it far too much. I'm just at home and I've got a few weeks free and I don't feel the urge to just give myself a whole lot of extra work and get back to something. I think a workaholic is someone who does that and can't actually stop, and they feel weird when they haven't got much on. Whereas I actually really enjoy the breaks and could imagine having longer ones, to be honest. But I just engage, I just engage too much with opportunities to do interesting things, and then they keep rolling on and there's just something to be done again. There's another project to be doing. So the time starts filling up again. I used to be very bad at saying no, and I used to have too many things to do, because I've actually become a lot better at saying no to stuff. And I won't be able to fit it in. I'll just be stressed and hectic. And so it's not so much being a workaholic as in my mind anyway, as just being wanting to engage with all the interesting things that come up. So
do you think that's because, I mean, being bad at saying no, do you think that's because maybe you didn't think that, making music was going to last?
It was just inexperience. I just wasn't experienced enough to understand how busy I would get. maybe a little bit of the thinking that, I don't work, I play music. Whereas actually, once you're starting to, you're playing music seriously and really kind of like putting a lot of concentration into it for 12 hours a day, it's exhausting. It's really very draining. So that was just a slow learning process about, you know, managing one's time better and learning how to say no.
But you know, being so proficient and being a bit of a multi-instrumentist and being able to conjure up new universes with anything that you find in a recording studio, how do you control yourself? Because sometimes having too many options can lead to an endless noodling and stuff. And how do you get the job done? I'm just not,
look, I don't know. I mean, I think look, if you kind of want to just start playing whatever, you know, being indulgent or something, I mean, for me, it's there's usually a fairly clear path, because someone, either my other people I'm working with or myself, there's a set of songs or a basic kind of idea around what is being done. And really, if you're working on making the song as effective as you can, then you're not doing a lot of noodling around. I mean, you can approach it in a lot of different ways, but I wouldn't suggest noodling's probably the best way to present us. You know, that's probably more the reserve of, you know, no insult, but like in jazz, you can noodle around and go along on long digressions and so forth. But if you're working on a song, really, you're in service to the song principally. And so as much as you try and find as many different ways, and as, well, I don't know what you said earlier, just like this whole universe of possibilities, and there's a huge number of possibilities of how what direction you can take a song in when it's just starting out. But the song still normally suggests a whole lot of things of itself, of the way it is. It's, you know, the principle, then there's the basic chords and lyrics, and it's like that, then you have a, it suggests a direction, usually, to me anyway.
This is something that interests me about the new album, Five Ways to Say Goodbye, because I don't know if you'll agree, but it's almost a concept album about saying goodbye. Do you sort of tend to start with an idea for a record, or do you just kind of like start with songs and the idea comes later?
Well, yeah, but no, there's usually an idea for the album in a way, and I suppose I was doing other things and working on other things with people, and then this collection of songs was sort of there. There were a couple of songs I'd written and one or two that I was interested in, and when I looked at them, that was the common theme, and when I looked around, it didn't take me very long to see the other things that I'd like to do that were thematically connected, so somehow it just became... The theme sort of shaped the songs that I chose to, and one of the ones that I wrote as well. So because there was a song that I liked, the song When We Were Beautiful and Young, is about saying goodbye to youth, I suppose, and I didn't have a song like that in there. I think probably I was talking to someone about, you know, those classic songs like When I Was 25 and, you know, Windmills of Your Mind and things like that, and I just felt that I didn't have the song like that, so I actually just had to write it. But I wrote it very quickly, probably in an hour or something. So, but yeah, that was the same with the sketches from the Book of the Dead album. You know, I just noticed that I had three or four songs, and they were thematically in that area, and it probably holds for all those albums, actually, that the kind of concept around three or four songs has suggested the direction to go and which songs to do. So,
and are you an artist that enjoys nostalgia and looking back? Because you seem so busy all the time and looking forward. I wonder.
Well, it is principally, yeah, I do just keep moving to the next thing. So it's interesting. I am someone, as a person, I can have periods of being quite nostalgic and, you know, sentimentality or something. But broadly speaking, I think I keep moving forward with the next thing. I don't really sit around looking back. You know, people ask me, oh, you know, have you listened to this album or that album of yours? And I just say, well, I really don't listen to my back catalogue unless I have to. I'm just not interested to go back there. And I have to listen to it anyway occasionally when they send me test pressings or there's remasterings, and I have to check them anyway. So I get to hear all a lot of the old stuff that I've made over the years from time to time anyway, and that's quite enough.
Yeah.
I don't need to go. I'm certainly not interested in going. So I do, broadly speaking, keep moving forward just to the next project, and then I'm working on the next project, and that's what I'm concerned with. Yeah, I think that's a healthy way to go about it. I don't think as any artist should really be spending too much time looking backwards.
Because the new album also includes, it's a blend of songs you've written and songs other people have written, originally performed by other mm-hmm. people. And you don't like the word covers, right?
Well, I think it's used in the pejorative for the most part. It's just sort of used, there's almost a negative attachment to that terminology. And, they're just doing covers. It's like, it's used in that way sometimes. Oh, they've just done covers, they're not good enough to write their own songs or something. And I don't really see that whole undertaking in that way at all. It's really part of, it's part of what musicians used to do all the time, actually, before the Beatles. People in bands didn't really write their own songs. Singer performers didn't write their own songs. There were songwriters in the background in the songwriting building, in the Brill building or somewhere, writing songs for them. So it's something that's probably come along since the Beatles, mostly. It's sort of in the 60s it became, now everyone's expected to write their own songs, but I don't think it's necessarily that important. I think going back and, I'm not a prolific songwriter, so, and it's never been a thing for me where it's the main thing for me. So I guess I just approach the song selection or whatever it is with just I'm not really concerned about it being all, writing all the songs. I mean, on Sketches from the Book of the Dead, I did write all the songs, but that was because I realized the whole concept around the project was highly personal, and that I should, to make it function in the way it had started, I needed to sit down and write them all. So I did. So then I had a project to do that. But when I look at something like this new album, it's this things about farewell and so forth, and there's plenty of great obscure songs out there, and I'd already been touching on a couple of them already, and I really like to do that, to bring the extant songs into circulation and keep them going and expose more people to, there's so many great songs out there,
Speaking of,
so I don't mind about that. But the term cover is actually, as I often explain to people, refers to an old style thing that used to happen. I don't know if you're aware where the word cover version comes from.
No.
It's actually when they couldn't get the master tapes to all the different parts of the world. It was a manufacturing issue, and they would get local bands in lots of different countries to completely copy the original recording, and then they would put a different cover with that band's name on it, and it would be released with that cover on it.
I did not know that.
Wow. That explains sometimes you'll hear a recording of a song, it's like, that doesn't sound like the one I heard in Germany.
But it's really, really similar. So, I mean, even in Australia, there used to be bands, a band would do a version in Adelaide, and a different band would do a version of the same song in Melbourne. And they'd have hits in the different cities with it. And they were cover versions, so they'd have their cover on it. So I don't think that's what I'm doing. I know that it's me being pedantic, but I don't care. I'll just be pedantic about it.
No, but
I'm not copying. It's almost like saying it's a copy, and I don't feel like that's what I do. And I don't, and I often cite a couple of my favourite artists who also would probably have only one or two songs that they'd written per album, like Johnny Cash and Nina Simone, and nobody says, oh, they're just doing cover versions.
Yeah.
Well, so that's like whether you own the song or whether you make it your own, and whether there's a purpose to you doing it, it's really about, that's what it's about, and what you're bringing to it and what you're giving people to listen to that's new and different. That's the important thing about making music, full stop, really.
Mm. No, it's interesting because, I mean, I I'm going to use the expression cover version because I don't see it as a
go ahead.
As a
go ahead.
version.
But I always think like sometimes it's been lost. Like if you go back to the Motown acts, were really good at doing cover versions of other people's songs.
And of each other, like. Yeah, they were, like you'd have Motown artists
doing
the same songs.
Like Stevie Wonder, who's a brilliant, brilliant songwriter, but can also like do, you know, cover the Beatles or something like that. And I do wonder if that's been lost. I mean, obviously, I know.
You're
maintaining. Well, I mean, it's in Europe, it's usually referred to as, or used to be as in interpret or interpretations or whatever, which is, that's the kind of traditional way to talk about that, where people are doing interpretations, you know. That's their interpretation of the thing. So, you know, Tom Jones didn't write songs, did he?
No.
Nobody's bothered about that. Nobody ever talks about it.
yeah, because he's such an incredible performer. That, you know,
but I mean, it's really what you bring to it, isn't it? So that's all. That's all. That's enough about that. I mean, my purpose is to and mostly, for the most part, I reckon 9 out of 10 of the songs that I'm performing that are written by other people are pretty obscure, like they're not known by most people who'll be hearing them. So it's like it's also like sharing information and culture and art with your listeners. It's like part of the purpose of it anyway. So for me, it's all just part of the same process. And the songs that I write, and I do write, I've written quite a few now over the years, and they're not more important to me than the other stuff. They're not more important to me because I wrote them or anything. I just don't see them that way. They're all just part of the same thing to me.
Well, for instance, you've got an interpretation.
No, we've established when you could the modern use of cover is, you know, obviously it's changed. So please go ahead. I won't be insulted.
We Had an Island is written by Bruno Adams of a band called Fatal Shore, which I had never heard of before. Reading about the fact that it's on Five Ways to Say Goodbye. Were they close friends? Because their biography seems very similar to your steps with Birthday Party and.
Well, Bruno is the brother of Bronwyn Adams, who's in Crime and the City Solution. So I've known him, you know, he was much younger than me, or significantly younger, certainly at the time when we were setting out with the Birthday Party and so forth. He was still like a teenager, really 16 or something. And then his band, he was in a band called Once Upon a Time, who ended up in Berlin, and they were pretty underground. They were not, you know, they were a bit of an underground band. They were sort of well-known a bit in Eastern Europe, while it was still opening up, and living in Berlin. And then he, I think Once Upon a Time eventually disbanded, and he started Fatal Shore with a couple of, you know, with Bill Schoenfeld and so forth. And that's just one of their songs. So I did a song of Bruno's on the first album too, called Planetarium, which is on One Man's Treasure. So, you know, he's a, Bruno's, you know, he's a very important, he was an important person for me, and I really loved his songwriting. So, yeah. But he was Australian, and but he lived the last 25 years of his life in Berlin. So
yeah. Mm. And speaking of more interpretations, a lot of what we're going to be able to enjoy from you in your visit to Spain is songs from Phantasmagoria in Blue, this album of where you interpret songs by Leonard Cohen, Tim Buckley. And or lesser known maybe to the general audience, Larry Smokey Mims, Sybil Beyer, and many others. Can you tell us about what this show, because you're going to be duetting them with Amanda Acevedo, who sings on the record. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, how did you meet Amanda? Because this is quite an interesting story, I understand.
I suppose so. I mean, it's a modern story in a way. I'm not a particularly modern guy in that way, but. She was a lot of people follow you online, you know, okay, so as an artist or whatever, even being on Facebook, you have an official page and all this. It's a little bit different than being on social media when you're in my position, because there's a lot of fans out there, so it's more like you have an official page and you don't really use it in the way most people use social media, I suppose. So I became aware that Amanda, there was this young Mexican girl who was like obviously a really big fan of what I was doing, and things she said about what I was doing were really quite charming and you know, very it was very quite flattering actually. And I kind of contacted her at one point because we were going to Mexico. I was on the PJ Harvey tour, and we were going to Mexico. I think it was the last show of the entire tour actually in 2017. And I contacted her. So I hadn't spoken to her. I was aware of her, and I just sent her a message and said, "Oh, look, we're coming. Hi, Amanda, we're coming to Mexico. If you want to come to the show, I'll get you tickets or whatever." And I just knew she was 17 or something, so she wasn't going to be probably able to afford the tickets to the Corona Festival in Mexico City. And it became apparent that she wasn't even in Mexico City. She was 6 hours north of Mexico City in San Luis Potosí. Anyway, so her father brought her down. We met there in Mexico City. That was really nice. And we just kind of kept up communication and in bits and pieces through the next few years. Hmm. And then really when the pandemic began and we were sort of locked down, we just started communicating a bit more, and little by little we started.
Sorry, Mick, I don't know if you hear us, but you've paused.
Am I losing network?
Oh no, here we are. You're back.
Have
you're
I lost
back.
You?
Sorry. You were telling us that she'd come down with her father to the festival. And during pandemic, you were
trying to hack in here.
Yeah,
there's someone trying to hack into my computer. I think
the goblins
blocking this thing.
The goblins are there. You were telling us. So we lost you when you were talking about during the pandemic. You were communicating.
Oh right. Okay. So we started exchanging files and about different things, just ideas actually. And then she kind of asked at some point if I was interested to do a song with her, just for her personal, you know, enjoyment. And I was pretty wary about that. And I said, she's sort of doing that with a couple of other people online, sort of exchanging files with people in Germany and stuff. So she sent me the song that they'd recorded, and I recorded some vocals on it and sent it back. And I just really enjoyed the process. And so, you know, in all those lockdowns and everything, we just started exchanging ideas, and the whole project just evolved, which was quite probably quite common at the time, actually. I think a lot of people had experiences like that where they had long distance connections and created albums long distance because it was the way to do it. So yeah. It grew out of that, and it's been great fun. And we ended up with an album of covers primarily because Amanda wanted it to be that way, actually. She was driving that. I was quite keen to have more original songs, but I think she felt that it should be she wanted the whole thing to be she didn't want us to be writing original songs on it for some reason. I wasn't quite sure why. I always like to have a couple of original songs at least on there because that are in context, because I think it creates a just a personalization and another view into what's being done. So we ended up some kind of compromise thing. There were a couple of songs there. We have actually written quite a lot of songs, which we'll be working on in the future for some next project, I guess. But we ended up with this album. So there are some translations of things on there too. Eduardo Ruiz Arte song is on there, and there's a Silvio Rodriguez song on there, both translated sort of from Spanish and or half sung in Spanish at times. And it's just it's been great fun and very enjoyable having someone to collaborate like with that and just bounce ideas off. And it's really helpful for me actually to have someone like that.
And that's a dream come true for her. I mean, she's this fan of your work, and all of a sudden now, years later, she's touring with her idol.
I know, it's a bit
on an album that they recorded today. You know, it's.
I know, it's a bit crazy. I'm sorry. I really must apologize for
no,
that.
No, but you've made someone's dreams come
true. I know.
True.
Well, and a great record.
And a great record, yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that's the – thank you. I think that's the important – I hope the record's really good, and there's really – you know, and she's probably driven more of the song choices than I did and really informed the kind of atmosphere and direction of the record more than I did. You know, she was the most of the ideas were coming from her, so I love that. I love that. I really enjoy being there and kind of helping people realize that, you know, that's what I've done mostly in my career, been the arranger and the kind of help to focus everything and bring the whole idea together for people to help them in that pursuit. So yeah. That's a kind of natural role for me. But it was great, great fun recording the album, and very, really enjoyable, and obviously amazing for her. She must be, she must think it's pretty bizarre.
You mentioned translation, actually. I wanted to ask about translation because I'm a big fan of Serge Gainsbourg, and you've done 4 albums now of his songs, and you've translated lyrics into English. And it always strikes me as his lyrics are incredibly difficult to translate. I mean, Je t'aime moi non plus, which you translated as literally as I love you, nor do I, is just strikes me as very hard to translate. You know?
There's always twists in his lyrics. So it's very hard to translate all of the detail of the word plays and everything in his lyrics, because there's and you accept that. You attempt to get as much of that as you can, but obviously with linguistic differences, just some things are lost. But I think the pursuit of that was really worthwhile. I've had so much feedback from people who it really helped introduce them to his work, because they just don't speak any French. So then actually 90% of what he's doing is completely lost on them, because they can't get the, and so actually it's revealed an awful lot of a view into what he was doing, even if it's slightly deficient in some ways.
No.
Even Nick Cave said that he loved it, because it really helped him understand what Gainsbourg was about and what he was doing with the areas that he was working in lyrically and so forth, even if they're not 100% precise, or they can't be exactly the same. It still has a purpose, and it was also great fun doing that, and really challenging. And I enjoyed that. I understand French people. That's pointless for French people. I get that.
No, but it's amazing, because
I don't really care. I didn't do it for them.
But it was amazing because Intoxicated Man came out in 1995, back when, frankly, outside of France, not a lot of people were talking about Serge Gainsbourg.
No, they weren't. No, that's true. So he's kind of, I wouldn't be the only person who's, continued to pump up his tires or, make him visible out there. I mean, his work kind of stands up. His oeuvre, or whatever you call it, and he would have been. I think he would have come to have the presence in the place that he has now, anyway. Personally, but certainly, yeah. When I did that album, it was a bit like he wasn't really talked about much. No, outside of France, no.
Speaking of oeuvre. Mick, your body. Did I say it right?
Yeah, very nicely. Yeah,
merci. I mean, you've got so many decades of such high quality work left behind you. Is there something that you're most proud of? Something where you've really conquered a barrier that you struggled with of all your career? I mean, if you had to pick,
Yeah, no, I'm not very good at that. I kind of
how could you be?
I kind of really I'm aware that there's a huge amount of stuff there, and I'm very I don't know if proud's the right word, but certainly pleased and kind of happy with almost all of what I've done. Really, I mean there are things that I would do differently if I went back, but not a lot. And I'm just very pleased that the people are still interested in the work and still enjoying it. That's very gratifying,
Yeah.
I'm very, really trying to avoid the word proud, because I don't really think I'm a bit wary of pride.
Yeah.
There is an element, I guess, of pride in your work in that way, but if you say that's what it is, there's other ways of looking at it, I think, rather than just feeling proud about it.
Yeah.
So because the work itself is, it's not really there. It's not really about your boosting your ego, is it? And making you feel proud of what you've done. That's not really the purpose of doing the work in the first place. So it's about expression, about trying to put things out there that are for yourself too, like as an artist. So I try and but it's very hard for me to pick specific things. I mean, the birthday party documentary came out last year in Australia. I think it's probably it's a bit released in Europe, not very much. I'm not sure where it's been showing in Europe. It did very well in America.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that just seeing that band, that sort of starting point I had even when I was just in my early 20s, and it's kind of amazing to look back on that. And, and see what we were doing then, and then just think about that it's just been carrying on as intensively as that in terms of being creative for 4 decades since then. It's a bit scary, really.
Yeah. And do you find it humorous, the fact that, you know, in the early days, it sound like birthday party that had such an aggressive aesthetic to a lot of the sound, and all of it, you know, and over the years you've left space for symphony, should I say, or melody, and your music now is more certainly not as aggressive to listen to as some of the early birthday party albums.
Well, I mean, I think yeah, it's funny with that, because a lot of what the birthday party was about was basically saying, well, you can do whatever you want to, you know, and just take it to as far as you can, you know. Yeah. We can take it this far. This is how far we're willing to go with our work. And it was difficult listening. It wasn't easy listening. It was there was no commercial consideration. And I would actually just say that I think almost everything I've done has continued to have that exact same positioning with regard to commerciality and a level of difficulty for the listener. I mean, albums that I've been making recently, they're not, the subject matter is not something that's that people are very comfortable with listening to most of the time, in my experience. You know, they'd much rather listen to Taylor Swift singing a breakup song, and I'm really not interested in doing that at all. So, you know, and there's certain subject matters that are really, really easy to sell to people, and types of music as well. And I don't think I've ever really played those.
Yeah.
So whilst the birthday party might be obviously extreme, like there's an extremity in the sound, it's really noticeable. I think the choices about what I've continued to play and work with have still been informed by the same kind of attitude.
Yeah.
So,
well, congratulations, because your new album, 5 Ways to Say Goodbye, will be available
May the 10th
on Mute, a wonderful label. And you shall be stepping on one of our beloved stages here in Barcelona, the 17th of May, with Amanda Acevedo presenting songs of Phantasmagoria in Blue. And I imagine you will you be playing?
And we'll be doing songs from the 2 albums, and some other stuff, some older songs too, probably.
The wonderful thing is, one of the things I love is that people often come to Spain, they play Barcelona, Madrid, but not many people go to Valencia and Zaragoza, as you are also doing. So,
I know it's fairly typical to go to Barcelona and Madrid, I guess, but I mean, I've played down in the south a bit too. I like going to other places.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't happen all the time.
Well, we will definitely try and go and see you.
Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to your visit, Mick. Thank you so much for joining us.
That's
for taking
a
the time.
Pleasure. Thank you for your interest, and I can go and have a glass of wine or something now.
Oh, lucky I'm man!
It's 9 o'clock, I think.
Oh. 9 o'clock. Nine in the evening here. I can just go and chill out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Enjoy it. Enjoy it. Good man.
thank you.
Thank you, Mick.